Welcome to Climate Talk Uganda. I am Josephine Karunji. July 23rd this year saw the meeting in Zimbabwe of the 15th Conference of Parties to the Convention on Wetlands. As we've touched on this in the podcast several times, wetlands are one of the key environmental resources we have. They're incredibly productive ecosystems when they're healthy, with countless species of plants and animals, including us, relying on them. And the convention is designed to provide a framework to protect them from destruction because of climate change or other pressures like pollution and development. Now, nearly 90% of UN countries have agreed to be parties to this convention. Russia and the US have opted out. Uganda, though, has very much opted in, joining way back in 1988. So today on Climate Talk Uganda, we're talking to Asadu Sebioto, who is a senior wetlands officer in the Ministry of Water and Environment here in Uganda, and he's just back from Zimbabwe.
The trip was excellent. I think it was magical because it was still Africa, so everything was like home.
When you say everything was like home, what does that look like?
The African setup, the freedom, the environment, like you could easily sync with the environment that you are working in.
So I started this podcast speaking about wetlands and praising them and saying all of these things. Why are wetlands important? Why are they so special?
Thank you, Zephine, for that question. I think before we proceed, we need to first understand, before we understand the importance of wetlands, we need to also first understand what are wetlands, because we need to know how do we define wetlands. And I think a wetland is one of the most important ecosystems we have, especially like for a country like Uganda. And we need to understand that there are factors that define what makes up a wetland. And when you're looking at wetlands, basically, in science, we go with four factors that when you see them, you know that it's a wetland. Number one, wetlands have special, first of all, it must be wet. There must be water. The second characteristic is about the soils. Wetland soils are special from other soils that we get upland. So when you find special soils, like, for example, there's a type of soil we call peat. For those who want to understand what peat is, like that dark, half-decomposed soil that we always see in wetlands, where you usually step and you feel like a sponge, that's peat. We have clay. We don't expect you to find clay on a hill. So don't expect you to go to Nagulu Hill and you find clay. Clay will be found in wetlands. We have sand. Wherever you find sand, most cases that will be a wetland. So there's a specific type of soil that must be in wetlands, and those three are found in wetlands. You won't find them elsewhere. That's not a wetland. So when we go into addition, like, for example, I said water, it has to be water. Somebody says, but I don't see water here, it's not a wetland. Wetlands are of two types. We have seasonal and permanent wetlands. And when you look at a country like Uganda, 13% of this country is wetlands. It shows you how important they are. 13% is wetlands. Before we add on lakes, which we have in plenty, and open water and rivers. But of that 13%, you realize that almost, let's say, almost 75% to 80%, these are seasonal wetlands. So when we talk about seasonal wetlands, because I've said there are two types of wetlands, seasonal and permanent. So seasonal wetlands are those ones where you see us always fighting with people, because people always say, I don't see water here, but you are telling me it's a wetland. It's because it only gets wet for not more than 4 months in a year. And the permanent wetland is wet for more than 4 months in a year.
I said, you're moving really, really, really fast.
Yes.
And you're telling me things I didn't know. Mm. So it's just hit me that wet land. Mm. So I'd never thought of rivers and lakes and categorized them there.
Yes.
So first, school me on that.
For example, a wetland, that's why I went into describing the characteristics of wetland, the four characteristics: plants, water, animals, and soils. That becomes a wetland. When we come to, for example, rivers and lakes, Uganda has basically, its wetlands lie basically mostly in two types. We have what we call lacustrine wetlands and riverine wetlands. Lacustrine wetlands are those that exist along lakes. Like, for example, you go to Lake Victoria, then you find a large expanse of a wetland. That is a lacustrine wetland. It is existing along lakes. Then the second category we have in Uganda are riverine wetlands. After the river, you find a small patch of wetland that acts as a buffer, and those are riverine wetlands. Let's take an example of one wetland that you know very well, Lubiji.
Mm-hmm.
You know Lubiji wetland here that borders Kampala and Wakiso. When you look at Lubiji wetland, Lubiji is a permanent wetland. But Lubiji does not exist alone. Lubiji is just a small arm. For you might see it as big, but Lubiji goes and feeds into Mayanja. I think you know Mayanja wetland, the one that you always see that crosses in the Buloba, that side, that is Mayanja. So Mayanja becomes a very like big permanent wetland. If this Lubiji doesn't exist, you will not have Mayanja. And Mayanja to exist, because even Mayanja is also still a small wetland, because Mayanja goes ahead and feeds into Kafu. You know Kafu that comes from Bunyoro. So you can see how wetlands move. So none of our wetlands in Uganda exist alone. So most of these that we call seasonal wetlands, and why people always tell us, but you people from government, from NEMA, you are always chasing our people from wetlands, you are slashing people's cabbages. It's because that small wetland where that cabbage is, that's where the problem is. Like you saw, I'm in charge of data management. And basically what my role does is to inform decision makers, like my bosses who sit in parliament and where to draft budgets and everything. If you come to me and you ask me where should we go and put emphasis, I should say go back to those cabbage people. They are the ones that we have to slash, those banana people, those maize people, because that's where the problem is, because they are in these seasonal wetlands. They go for these seasonal wetlands because they believe these seasonal wetlands cannot like have water to destroy their plants. But if you dry up these seasonal wetlands, you will not have the permanent wetlands we are talking about. And when you dry up these permanent wetlands, you will not have the River Nile we are talking about. You will not have the Lake Victoria we are talking about. You will not have all those big rivers we talk about. Because those rivers, do they come from heaven? They are coming from these sources, the ones that we call seasonal wetlands. That's why we put emphasis on them. Because if we lose 75% of our wetlands, what shall we have? The other 25% will dry. So you've seen how I've tried to explain it. If you see Lubiji, Lubiji goes, Lubiji pours into Mayanja, Mayanja pours into Kafu, and Kafu pours into Victoria Nile. You can see the linkage.
Without
all the Mayanjas, you don't have Kafu. And without all the Kafus, where will Nile get water?
Nile, okay.
Yes.
The way you're explaining it, means it's a different explanation from everything else I've had. When you're explaining to the people putting these cabbages, when you're explaining to the people in Lubiji, because there's always a lot of fighting around that side on encroachment and so on, what are you saying to them? How are you educating them, informing them about the benefit of this wetland and why they need to move?
It's important that our people understand that these wetlands feed all of us. And I think that was first enshrined in our constitution when Uganda was drafting its 1995 constitution, and to make sure it puts the function of providing a clean and healthy environment in the hands of government. Because if we had left this function to individuals, like how we sell people own land, and we say let people own the forest, let people own the wetlands, you will wake up one day when somebody has blocked off Lubiji. But remember, we have what we have upstream and downstream. So what about those users downstream? Won't they get water? That's why government had to keep those powers, because water is for all of us. So if you come and you dig somewhere, you are spraying, you are doing everything, because you know nowadays they use a lot of spraying, they use a lot of fertilizers. Because for you want food, yes, it is going to give you food at the moment. But as you are spraying and everything, downwards, people are fetching water. This is like a linkage. It's a line that some of us don't even monitor. But if you realize from some of the studies, because we have, of course, researchers who go on doing these studies, if you do realize the amount of chemicals that are in this water, the fertilizers and everything, but it is being done by somebody who has just planted maybe a 50 by 100 plot of cabbage, but is causing damage to an entire village downstream that is using this water. So you can see why we tell them, like, you need to leave these wetlands. You do agriculture outside, get water from the wetlands. And I think that's what government has been trying to do. That's what the Minister of Water has been trying to do. try to get this water out, give it to the people up for mini irrigation and maybe large irrigation schemes, if that's what they want. Because usually we have what we call community wetland management plans. We want to develop them with the communities. And when we go there, we usually ask them a historical analysis. Communities themselves, we don't. If you go on our websites, you'll see some of these community wetland management plans. We don't develop them from office. So we usually ask the people who are in their 80s and 70s, was this wetland like this? Then they tell you, no, you see, Mtavan, these things, this wetland was intact. So we ask them, so why is it degraded now? Your grandfathers left it intact because of a reason. So for you, why do you want? Because we want rice, we want to get school fees. After school fees, are you now going to go and dig in the river when the wetland is dry? When you say fertility is done, uplands, and you go to wetlands looking for fertility because of the peat soils, if the peat soils also get finished, what next? Is that the solution? So people have to understand that wetlands, these are systems.
What is a wetland in your language?
Orutobas.
In any other language in Uganda?
In Runyako, it is Ebisharara.
In another language?
Another language, Ebisaru.
Let's go back to where you just came from. You just came from Zimbabwe.
Yes.
For the COP15, the 15th meeting of the Conference of the Contracting Parties.
Yes.
That was 23rd to 31st July. 23rd
to 31st July.
What was your role there?
Basically, in this COP, we are trying to also display, number one, what Uganda is doing, because this convention is about wetlands and how people are conserving wetlands, because the essence of joining it is to showcase and share lessons, but also learn how countries are managing wetlands. So basically, our role there, and basically my role there, was to showcase what we are trying to do. I had a presentation on how we are using mapping, that's GIS and remote sensing technologies, to do wetland inventories. Many of the countries, and like how the Ramsar Convention and the Ramsar Secretariat, it has realized that many countries don't even have wetland inventories. They don't know where their wetlands are, what are the wetland types they have, what is being done in these wetlands. And that's how we came in, because we want to share our lessons. As Uganda, we've moved a step ahead. We've tried to rely on use of GIS and remote sensing technologies to do a comprehensive wetlands
geographical
information systems and remote sensing. In summary, what we call earth observations, that's use of satellites to make sure that we know and map where our wetlands are. We are like a benchmark in the region in this field.
I understand that this convention was held weeks after scientists had released a strong warning about the destruction and declining health of wetlands globally. They describe the decline as an overlooked crisis that threatens food and water security and worsens climate change. How would you describe it?
If, for example, if we talk now about climate change, climate change is, I think, the biggest lion now we have in this world, not actually Uganda alone, and it's causing havoc everywhere, like when we talk about the hunger, the diseases, the droughts and everything. And now here comes in wetlands. And that's why focus is now shifting a lot to wetlands. Focus previously was on trees, you remember?
Yeah.
Trees and forests and everything. But with most science, actually scientists have discovered that these wetlands, especially those that have peat, are storing more carbon, like 3 times more carbon than forests do. So as people come, the ones you've been talking about, the cabbage growers, the sugarcane growers, the farmers, the people who are doing, the rice growers, they are digging. And as they are digging, they are turning this pit on top. This pit is not meant to turn on top. It is meant to stay there. Because when it stays there, it is the one that is helping us store that water, number one. That's why you see it is a sponge. When you hold it, water comes out. Why? Because whenever it rains, it is keeping for you that water and it is releasing it slowly so that you continue having a continuous flow of water all year round. But when you come and remove this pit, you come, you dig a drainage channel, it means water is just going to run. That's why you see flooding. So now when we come to this pit, apart from storing that water, this pit has carbon. So as people dig, they are turning this peat upwards. And when it's exposed, we have oxygen in abundance. So in science, when oxygen meets carbon, they create carbon dioxide. So scientists ended up seeing that wetlands can play a part, but we have to work together and conserve these wetlands so that we keep the carbon there. So they have not only stopped there, they go ahead and understand, even us as a country, that yes, the population, like it was in 1990, it's not the same way it is now. A lot of things have changed. So what are we going to do about this? People are looking for livelihoods. People have to eat, people have to survive. We cannot deny that because we are paying school fees and everything. People have kids to pay for school fees. What can we do as alternative sources of livelihood?
As I do paint the picture for me for Uganda, if we continue playing with our wetlands at the rate at which we are, what will our future look like 10 years from now, 20 years?
It's very scary. That's the first word I can say. If we look back at 1994, like I've said, we first did our wetlands event in 1994. But the first time we mapped these wetlands, we had 15.6% of wetlands covering this country. But of this 13%, the one I'm talking about, that is not what is intact. So that 13% is the general wetlands, whether built up, like the way you see the people have built in Kampala, where you see rice farms in Ireda, where you see it is part of this 13%. So when you deduct from that moment, our wetlands coverage now stands at 9.3, the one we can call a healthy wetland. So people need to understand, why do we need to protect these wetlands? Number one, flood regulation and flood mitigation. We've had a lot of issues on flooding. Whenever flooding comes, we lose billions. I'm telling you, here in Kampala, you might take it as a joke, but I've moved up country, especially in the east. You find a bridge broken down in just one season, and the bridge is like 3 billion. This is for a district. When will this district ever get money? For example, I was in Manafa. There's a river called the Kamisaru. When will this district ever get 3 billion again to construct this? They've spent like 2 years without having that bridge constructed up to now. But it would have been solved by one simple thing, conserving the environment. You get it? So people need to understand this. Number two, diseases. You are digging in the wetland, you are spraying, you are using fertilizers. And that is the order of the day nowadays. Whoever is doing agriculture, 98% in wetlands, they are using the spraying, whether it's rice and everything, for pests, for diseases, for what they are spraying. And in the end, this is the same water we are taking. Because here in Kampala, we have an advantage that we have taps where water first goes to national water and is treated. But in communities, they don't have that luxury. They have to go to the same river where he went and dug up. He has to go to the same river down in the stream and fetches water for drinking and for their animals. So you can see the cycles and you can see the increased incidences of cancer. You go to the villages and start saying, why are these people suffering from cancer? But was cancer there in the last 20, 40 years in that area? No. So we have to conserve wetlands. We have to make sure that we leave wetlands to do their job. We should not do things that aren't allowed in the wetlands. And the good thing in our laws in Uganda, we put there things that are allowed and not allowed in the wetland. So wetlands are not meant to be left there. And that's what I think when you read about the Ramsar Convention, that's what the Ramsar Convention is talking about. Wise use of wetlands. Are you using the wetlands wisely? Because they're meant to be used. They are a resource from God to us. But how are we using them?
What's been the most surprising thing you've discovered while you were mapping Uganda's wetlands?
The most surprising thing is, like I've said, what degraders are very smart people. And I think I've been surprised for the 8 years I've worked in wetlands. I've been surprised by how sharp and creative they are. But I've also been surprised that in the sensitization meetings, people know that they are doing wrong. It's a big surprise. I've attended several meetings, community meetings at village level. And these people actually, they know the importance of wetlands.
So if ignorance is not the excuse, what's the excuse?
Livelihoods. livelihoods. And that's why every now and then the problem that now we are tackling is as we are restoring, as we are removing these people from the wetlands, so, do we have alternative sources of livelihood? Yeah. So all donors, all even government itself, plus our development partners, when they come to us and they say we want to restore our wetlands, we first tell them, do you have a component on livelihoods? Because if we go and we restore a wetland, we take people out who have been doing rice, and the papyrus comes back, then what? For example, we did some simple mathematics. If you look at how destructive rice is, somebody comes and destroys a hectare of a wetland to put rice. But from there, he's going to get one bag of rice, let's say, or 2 bags. And from there, you'll get, like, let's say, 200,000 shillings. We tell them, but you see, when we restore this wetland and we give you apiary, beehives, you start beehives, 1 liter of honey is 40,000, or actually 30,000, let's say. Let's put it to the list. 1 liter of honey is 30,000. But what time are you going to invest in apiary? Apart from us giving you the beehives, the apiary, because the bees need the water in the wetlands, they need the flowers from the papyrus, and they give you honey for you as you're doing other things. But rice, you have to be there, kids are not going to school, and you're not getting the money, but you're destroying the wetland. So can we stop this running back and forth? Let's give you this alternative source of livelihood. You find something else to do, but as you also get your honey, that is even more income generating than rice. And I think that's what the president has been trying to explain.
With everything that you know and everything you see happening, what keeps you awake at night?
Basically, is to make sure that I do the best to the job that has been granted to me, because I know it's an opportunity, first of all, to serve my country, but it's also an opportunity that I'm doing something that I love. I just love environment. And like you saw, my first degree is in environment science. So this is something that I do passionately. And every time I think about this, you'll never find me doing anything else. Even if it's at night, you'll find me either on maps, trying to see where these wetlands are, trying to inform stakeholders, what are you going to do? If you find me in the morning, you'll find me trying to write something. Previously, I used to write a lot about environment before I joined government, because government, we have our restrictions, so you don't just write if you're not the PRO. You don't just publish everything, because, of course, we have our PRO specialists and everything. So you realize it's about seeing how we make this world a better place, especially in terms of climate change, because, like it or not, it's the biggest challenge that this world is facing right now. That's why we have all those international agreements talking about climate change. But now, me as a person, a specialist who's focused on wetlands, what role can I play to make sure that my impact is felt in this sphere of wetlands conservation? Because this is a resource that we have. Mind you, we have to know that our parents paid us using coffee. Money. Most of our parents studied school fees and everything comes from agriculture, because it's the backbone of this country. But when you look at this country, how do we do our agriculture? Our agriculture is rain fed. If it rains, well and good. If it doesn't rain, losses. Ask yourself, where does this rain come from? Our rain comes from the water bodies we have, the wetlands we have, and the forests. So if we spoil these wetlands, shall we have food tomorrow? Shall we have the coffee we are talking about? Shall we be able to go to school? So I want people to understand why we have to conserve wetlands. That this is a line. For you might want to have food for today, but be assured your children will not have food tomorrow. You might want to do rice today in this wetland, but your children will not afford that rice tomorrow.
You've worked on some groundbreaking projects, like Uganda's first published wetland status report. What's one moment of that journey that stuck with you?
After, let me say, more than 30 years that this department has existed, since the first inventory in 1994. Before I joined government, even like with all the work that we are doing, we had never published a state of wetlands report. But I was very proud of myself and the team we work with to make sure that we generated this document. Because like I've said, wetlands is a specialty that is just developing in Uganda. But at least I'm very proud that with my inputs, with me being in office at that particular moment, we've been able to produce our first set of wetlands report. And now actually we even have a second one. It will be published soon. It's already there. Those who can visit the ministry can get it, but online we shall load it very soon. So that we make this a habit that every 4 or 5 years, we inform the people about where these wetlands are, where the challenges are, and it even goes down up to the lowest local government so that it informs their planning. Like, you know, Uganda is a decentralized system of governance. Even wetlands management is decentralized. But without these people having data, because they don't have the skills that we have here, they don't have that specialty to analyze that data. But if we break it down in the simplest terms, we show them where these challenges are. I think it is something that lays a big foundation and a big stone in our wetlands management sector.
My final question to you, Asadu.
Yes, please.
If you could click your fingers and fix something, 3 things, what would those things be?
Number one, it would be about sensitization and awareness. When people are aware, everything will be okay. You cannot do everything alone. People are the government. People are the government. So before we say government, Assad coming and chasing out of the wetland, the person is being chased should be aware because it's also part of government.
You look like someone who would come and chase me.
No, definitely. With wetlands, with wetlands, it's no longer an issue because we are promised. We don't chase you away, it's us who will be chased.
Your job.
So we have to, it's our job. It's you people paying us to do this work. So okay. We have to do it well because if we leave you, we are not working. So basically, sensitization and awareness. Number two, education. We have to take wetlands education seriously, back from the grassroots, from primary school.
Number three,
funding. The sector is underfunded. The sector needs funding. We cannot do anything without funding. When we come to, let's say, like, for example, you're working in NTV, you cannot make an advert on people to conserve wetlands. We cannot run adverts there because we don't have those funds. You need funding, even if you're going to do sensitization. Somebody will need fuel to drive to that community to do sensitization. So without funds, most of this will be just talk.
Asadu Sebioto is Senior Wetlands Officer in the Ministry of Water and Environment here in Uganda. And that's it for Climate Talk Uganda this week. Special thanks to our guest, Asadu Sebioto. Do you have anything, one more thing to say to us?
I just want to thank Climate Talks for giving me this opportunity. It's a wonderful opportunity. So like I've told you, this is something that I eat, sleep, and drink. So it's a wonderful opportunity, yeah. And also sharing a platform with Josephine. Of course, I used to work with Josephine, so it's been nice. So remember it.
So I'm Josephine Karunji. And remember, we depend on you, our listeners, for support. So if you like what we're doing and want to hear more, leave us a review and recommend us to your friends. And with that, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.